Now there are seven paths to superconscious experience. And these paths are related to the qualities, the rays which flow through your body. But your various bodies. First of all, let us consider something of the nature of the energy which comes in superconscious experience. It has been my joy, it has been the glory of my life to experience these energies of the spirit in many forms. Often, during my medical studies, when I was into middle age and struggling with studies that I shouldn't have looked at after the age of 22, I was weary. And it was a wonderful thing to feel in the stillness of the night the approach of a master, usually the Master Robert Browning, who would come to me and he would apply the stimulation of his glorious energies to the cortex of my brain, my tired brain, my bewildered and befuddled cortex. It was a wonderful experience to feel the gentle stimulation of the cortex by his energies, and to awaken an hour later absolutely refreshed with a mind alert which only an hour previously or 2 hours previously had been befuddled. And the way in which we experience these energies is very, very different according to the rays that flood us. Some of you have the first ray of will and power strongly within you. Others have the rays of love, wisdom. Some of you are influenced by the rays of active intelligence. Others by the rays of art and harmony through conflict. Some of you have minds which respond to the fifth ray of concrete knowledge and analytical science. Some of you have respect for the ray of devotion and idealism, the ray of the Christian church. Still others of you are brilliantly organized and have the capacity to bring through the ray of ceremonial order and ritual and magic. All of us are different. How would we begin to recognize the qualities of energies which flow into us in meditation and higher experiences that I described earlier? Let me give you something of the qualities of spiritual force linked to the seven rays, for you would be on at least one or two of these rays. The ray of will and power produces a flow of spiritual energy down into the aura, which can be described as a torrent. A torrent. A torrent of energy. It is a torrent, and its weight and power can be felt as it streams into the aura. And all of you are going to experience it, whether in this life or in lives to come. Especially if in this lifetime you begin to meditate, you begin to align yourself with your soul. You'll experience the ray energy of the first ray of will and power as a torrent. And then there is the gentle energy of the ray of love, wisdom, the second ray. And it is a gentle ray that engulfs you. That is its quality, an engulfing energy. It comes, as it were, like a gentle wave lapping into your aura and engulfing you with warmth and with ecstasy and love and compassion and so on. The symbol that I would choose for it would be the point within a set of circles radiating outwards. Just as if you were the central part of a lake into which a stone had been flung. And you are engulfed, your aura is engulfed by these radiating waves of second ray energy. The energy of the third ray of active intelligence is very much different. It is, as it were, channeled energy. The energy of the third ray of active intelligence is channeled very specifically into several regions, into several pathways. If you like, you could take the seven candelabra of the Jewish religion, the seven zephyrot, and you could turn it upside down, and that would give you a perfect symbol of the way in which third ray energy enters into the aura and divides itself up into specific channels, each of which may take part of your aura and cleanse it. Then there is the fourth ray of art and harmony through conflict. And when you feel its energies coming into your aura, the energies are felt in, as it were, short, sharp spurts, like this, each one becoming increasingly intense or higher in spiritual content. That is how the fourth ray energy is felt. Harmony through conflict, crisis, then resolvement, crisis, resolvement. And that's the sort of energy, like a jagged sheet of lightning. Then there is the fifth ray energy, spiritual energy. This is felt as a whirlpool. It's felt, as it were, entering the aura as a sort of whirlpool. It starts at the periphery of the aura, and it spins around and finally reaches a point like that. The fifth ray of concrete knowledge and analytical science. The energy of the sixth ray is hard to describe. I've never been able to decipher it. I can only say that when the energy of the sixth ray of devotion and idealism floods your aura, which indicates that a master or an initiate is near you on that ray, the energy is felt as the energy of yearning, the quality of yearning, the sixth ray of devotion and idealism, the energy of yearning, Y-E-A-R-N-I-N-G. And then the seventh quality, finally, is an energy of the seventh ray of ceremonial order and ritual. And the quality of the seventh ray energy is felt as a diffused energy, a gently diffused energy, not caught up into any pattern, just like a spray, a fine mist of energy. Now, those are the seven energies that one experiences in superconscious experience. And I'm going to describe the seven paths to you after a break of 10 minutes. Thank you very much. Now we come to the seven ray paths. By that I mean that somewhere amongst the seven there is one or even two paths which are you, the path that is for you to take. And they are merely illustrative of a safe method to take you into the realm of the fifth kingdom, the realm of the superconscious. You'll remember, and I'm dealing now first of all with the seventh ray, the ray of ceremonial order and ritual. If you are a person who is on this ray, and you have certain qualities and capacities about you which emulate it, then this is the way for you. You'll remember that the energy of the seventh ray is diffuse. It's like a fine spray, the energy of the seventh ray. And this ray offers certain opportunities for a person to reach superconsciousness. The great capacity of these individuals over any others is their unusual ability to bring inner experiences into the outer world, to make manifest in the outer world their inner experiences. These people very frequently dream vividly, and their dreams are meaningful. Or they can think vividly, and they can think the most way out ideas and yet have the capacity to bring them into materialization in the outer world. But this capacity is two-way. And this is most important for you to understand. If you have seventh ray leanings, you can create things in the outer world which will produce similar experience in the inner world. This was the ancient basis for Tantra Yoga, which I deal with, Sunday afternoon. Tantra Yoga, where the experience of prolonged sexual orgasm was said to be the lower counterpart of the ecstasy of higher orgasm or superconscious experience. And the one was meant to program the person so strongly that he had inner experiences which paralleled it. Now, with the seventh ray, you arrange your temple, the place where you meditate, in a specific orderly way. again and again in this way, so that it triggers off inwardly certain experiences which are similar to this in the outer world. That is the great quality of the seventh ray, to mirror inwardly what is outward and to mirror outwardly what is inward, the great quality of the seventh ray. And so, by employing the right color for your ray, which would be violet, the right sound or mantra or any other magical formula that you have, you begin to attract to that temple, to that place where you meditate. Perhaps Harper is getting a set of stained glass windows which are built out of glass, the same glass that is used in Westminster Abbey. And this glass has certain colors, and these colors are related to this particular sign of the zodiac. And these colors are blended with the rays, and they will tend to produce color conditions in his meditation room, which will stimulate, as it were, the attraction of certain building devas. You have to understand that all ceremonial and magic is calculated to attract building devas. What do we mean by building devas? We mean that thoughts are things. Thoughts are tiny little living elementals. Other beings, other lives using this planet as a means of expression. We can encourage them into a room, encourage them into a temple with the right sort of sound and color and incense and other qualities. And when they are encouraged to come there, it is easier to build the antakarana out of them. You build an antakarana. There's the antakarana, from your lower nature to your higher nature, your higher triad. And if the room is filled with seventh ray energies, then you can, as it were, very easily, by drawing this, fashion your antakarana out of this material. That's what magic is all about, is attracting by means of certain formula, and if you heard my talk last night, you know exactly what I'm saying, attracting certain energies into a force field, which would be your temple or your meditation room. And out of this material, to be able to build an antakarana to the higher nature, leading to superconsciousness, or, if you wish, to use the same forces in healing in that temple. And by the end of the century, we're going to learn that certain individuals have the ability to attract healing devas. It also said that by the end of the century, it will be discovered that violet light attracts healing devas who heal, literally heal wounded flesh, cut flesh. And through the use of violet light and photography, it will be discovered, it will be seen quite clearly that that previously invisible lives assemble at the flesh to fill it in, build in the tissue that is of surgical healing, surgical wound healing. Now, when you create the right conditions, then these forces come to your aid in healing, in teaching, in whatever you are doing. It is said that very famous people like Harry Edwards have a healing deva, a deva of a high order, an angelic host, if you like, who assists him wherever he is, assists him in his healing method, hence his success in that particular field. A typical example of using seventh ray healing in such a temple would be this. The magician or the healer selects the correct note for the diseased tissue. Every tissue of the body has a different note to it. And if you select, if you're going to, as it were, heal the pancreas organ, then the note of the pancreas organ is the sixth ray. And the sixth ray note is one that we heard last night. Can anybody remember what it was? Ti? Do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti, do. And that note would be very, very appropriate for attracting devas that would build in the substance of the pancreatic tissue. And this could be used. Similarly, the patient himself could learn to sound a certain note, the note of the tissue that he needs to repair, especially muscular tissue. If the patient himself could sound, as it were, middle C, this would attract devas who would tend to build muscular tissue, to to repair muscular tissue. Just as we know also that the note fa, when persistently sounded, produces a green emanation which the devas of the green cue respond to. You sound the note fa, then it produces for the devas a green patch which attracts, as it were, the devas of the green cue. And they are particularly able to repair damaged or depleted nerve fibers. So here we have an example of magic and ritual being used in healing. And similarly, the magician may create a temple in a private room of his own with stained glass windows, incense of the right order, to build himself an antakarana. These people do very well when they have shapes for their temples of a specific kind. Such a person would do well to be able to sit in a pyramid, inside a pyramid, whether the pyramid is made out of perspex or tissue paper or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. But they would tend to be able to respond to the energies within that pyramid and so on. I love I'm going to try and quote a little piece of poetry to describe each of the qualities of the rays tonight. And for me, the piece of poetry that stimulates people on the seventh ray is this piece of verse. And if it sends chills down your spine, then you've almost certainly got the seventh ray somewhere in you. The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold. His cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of his spears shone like stars on the sea, where the waves roll nightly on deep Galilee. If purple and gold are your colors, then almost certainly you have very strong seventh ray attributes in you. Well, that's the way. Order. The building of a temple which attracts devas, the creation of a diffuse energy which can materialize things, build an antakarana, materialize tissue and healing, create, as it were, rapport between you and those you're trying to teach, the use of magic and ceremonial. Then we come to the sixth ray of devotion and idealism, the ray of Christianity. It is a ray of selfless devotion and martyrdom, if you wish. Here, the sensation is not one of order, it is the sensation of feeling. Feeling is important for the sixth ray of devotion and idealism. And therefore, one develops in this approach intense feeling for the master, intense feeling for him whom you are trying to reach. An intense feeling for him as he mirrors himself through your own soul. It doesn't matter whoever it might be. It could be the Christ, it could be Jesus, it could be the Lord Kutumi. That intense feeling for the Master. When you do any actions, when you undertake service activities, you dedicate the service work to the Master. If you are, or if you have been, for instance, the pupils, the neophytes of Mahatma Gandhi, then it would have been one of your service activities to get up before dawn in India, as a European, and to go down with a group of people into the villages, into the native villages, and scrub out the latrines every morning before dawn. To do that is hard for some people. But when it is done, and it is done as a dedication to the Master, it is good for the soul. In the sense that for those individuals, the intense devotion of the Master makes such a chore as nothing to them. And when you have such control over your personality as to be able to do that sort of thing, then you're on the sixth ray approach to his feet. There must be intense feeling with everything you do, intense feeling whilst you think of him, intense feeling whilst you are acting for him. And there must be the desire to be with him all the time, and it must be very, very strong. The use of music in this field can be helpful. People who are sixth ray respond to the music of musicians like Handel, and the use of the Messiah, the Hallelujah Chorus, which can give many of you that intense feeling, can conjure it up within you, so that you feel virtually you could almost just about reach him with that intense feeling. In ancient days, devotees would practice all sorts of self-discipline and asceticism. They would subjugate themselves, their personalities, entirely to some service, some target. Sometimes they would flagellate themselves, whip themselves, torture themselves, as it were, to get command of the body, the physical body, the emotional nature, and the mind. And when the command was theirs, to take that and give it to the master. Here it is, master, take it. I have subdued these bodies. They are all yours. I sacrifice them to you. Then there is the method of astral projection, which I shall deal with in detail on Sunday night, the techniques of astral projection. In astral projection, the person learns to discipline himself so severely through things like fasting, through stopping of smoking, through the stopping of meat eating, and so on. He learns to make his dream life very, very pure, very real, and as it were, what the hell have I got down here? Real and manageable. Very real and manageable. That's the essence of the discipline. It is by fasting and by self-discipline that the astral world becomes controllable and very real and is perceived accurately. It's when heavy meat eating is done and smoking that distortions of your view of the astral world are such as to make it impossible for you to operate there. And by self-discipline, the control of the astral world becomes immense. And then you go through a period of processing yourself in the dream state, so that you learn to recognize incongruities in your dream, which make you say, my God, this is an incongruity, this is a dream. I'm in the dream state, I'm in the astral world. I have only now to visualize the master's face in my mind, and I can fly to his feet because I have left my physical body behind in bed asleep. This is the way then of the sixth ray. Through intense devotion to the master, it is possible to reach his feet and have superconscious experience. Then there is the fifth ray of concrete knowledge and analytical science. The person who is analytical by nature must question everything, must have facts as the basis of his philosophy. These people must always take step by step, never taking another one until they have consolidated the first. These people tend to have an approach to the higher worlds through the act of focusing the mind. Focusing the mind, extreme concentration for them. Not just at first, and this is a procedure I suggest you all try, not just learning to look at something, but to learn to peer at something, which is very different from looking at it. Note the difference. Not just looking at something, but peering at it intensely. That's one of the steps. And then not just peering, but staring fixedly at something, especially when you have put something there, a thought form, and focusing your mind on a pinpoint of the most pregnant part of that thought form. That is what we're meaning. Not just self-hypnosis through staring at a rotating wheel, but many, many hours of studying the classics, the Upanishads, the great teachings of ancient wisdom, focusing your mind on them, and focusing your mind on the ideas that they express. Remember Kingsland a moment ago focused his mind on an idea expressed. Almost certainly he would have had a fifth-ray mental body. A fifth-ray mental body. Learning to do this in your innermost periods of retreat so that the lower mind becomes weary. The lower mind becomes weary. The senses become exhausted, and in the same way, whilst the lower mind becomes weary, the higher mind of abstract thinking becomes powerful, because you are studying abstract thought in the classics of ancient wisdom. The lower mind becomes exhausted whilst you pore over them, and the higher mind of abstract thought becomes stimulated and alert. In fact, this can produce, when you throw aside your books and go into a relaxed state, it can produce superconsciousness, especially if you retain what you had been studying in your book. Retain the symbol that you had been poring over in your mind and focus on it when you relax. That will take you to a superconscious experience. I know because I've had the experience 1,000 times, and it was produced in most instances merely through an act of studying the Catholics and then studying inwardly one of the symbols or one of the phrases from one of those Catholics and focusing the mind on it can take you into this higher experience. I don't know whether you've ever read about the effects of studying pictures of the masters. Get a valid picture of the master Kutumi or the master Moya, in whose ashram every one of you has served in one of your lives or the other, and focusing intensely on a valid picture of that master. To such an extent that when the picture is taken away, when the eyes are closed as it were, when the person is relaxed, the picture of the master is there in the mind. And because it is there, the master may energize that picture of him so that the picture actually talks to you. That is what we mean when we talk about focus, because that has happened to many, many people. The ability to focus the mind on the face of the master in some portrait or photograph. And then when it is no longer there, to hold that picture in your mind and to focus again on his face inwardly and to have superconscious experience with it. I often describe an experience that I had myself in this respect. Perhaps it would illustrate what I'm trying to say here. I had been driving from Detroit to New York. I had driven all day. And it was in late autumn, and the sun's setting rays, in fact right through the day, the sun's rays had lit up the yellows and the russets of the trees, the maple trees on the road over these mountains. And all day long as I was driving, these yellows and russets were being thrust into my vision as I drove the car, turning and so on, weaving my way through these long roads all the time. These waves of trees, the russets and the yellows were thrust into my consciousness hour after hour after hour. And that night I had a tremendous vision experience, a superconscious experience and a vision. And the whole of that vision was dressed in colors of autumn, russets and yellows, everything in it. What had happened was that just that color had triggered off within me, had programmed, if you like, within me some experience associated with its qualities. Think about these things that I say. You will see that they have intense application. Remember how I described in my book, Superconsciousness Through Meditation, how Somerset Maugham, the great novelist, was sitting in an art gallery in Italy looking at a picture of the Master Jesus seated at the table with the disciples at the Last Supper. And he was tired and exhausted from looking at pictures for many hours. And as he sprawled there, his gaze focused on the Master Jesus' face and this picture on the wall opposite to him. And suddenly he said the face of the Master Jesus turned from profile and looked straight at him in the eyes. And he was so startled that he leapt to his feet and put his spectacles on and went right up to the picture. And only when he was a few feet from it did the head of the Master Jesus turn back into profile as it really was in the picture. Somerset Maugham. Yes, there are many valuable clues in what I have just given to you. Then there is the fourth ray approach, the ray of art and harmony through conflict. Fourth ray of art and harmony through conflict, the ray of the artist, the ray of the mental body of most of you present in this room. Most of you have fourth ray minds. minds which have suffered intense mental crises in this life, minds that have grown because of those crises that you've had again and again in your lives. If you have a fourth-ray mind, then this is the sort of approach that might be for you if you are mentally and not emotionally polarized. Hear the note as harmony through conflict. There is intense conflict between the outer environment and its conditions and your own inner experiences. There's a conflict between the life that you are living in the outer world and your inner experiences. And the artist in such a situation struggles to get the right conditions in the outside world for him to depict what he is experiencing inwardly. If it's a sculpture, he has to struggle to find the money to buy the right piece of marble for him to chisel out that work of art which he has seen within his own inner experience. This is the struggle. The harmony must be derived out of such a conflict. This artist may then have to work day and night to finish some very little fragment of that work that he is trying to do. Because the inspiration is there and he must do it rapidly. And so we find this extraordinary characteristic of people on the fourth ray, that they are constantly at loggerheads with their environment. They want to, as it were, take their environment and shuffle it around and reassemble it on a higher vibration. They're never content with things exactly as they are, and they are constantly striving for a higher harmony with their environment. Now, when this is so, when they can raise the vibrations of their environment, these raise them. And this is a process that goes on all the time, and it produces artistic creativeness. Their environment may be just a picture. I'm not talking about the cleanliness of the room in which the artist works. I'm talking about the picture that he's painting or the sculpture that he's producing. If this is a high vibration, he is raising that, and he is raising this to the level of the vibration within him that is making him create that work of art. As I said last night of Renoir, Renoir said, "I may want a red to be sonorous like a bell. And if it doesn't turn out that way, I add more reds to it and other colors until I get it." It is the quality that artist is struggling to get. In the outside world, he's trying to make the painting or the music that he's creating of the same high vibration of what is inspiring him from his soul. And this is what this approach is all about. A very wonderful example of it is in Gerard Manley Hopkins, the modern poet who was a Catholic mystic. He used to see things in nature. And so wonderful were these things in nature that they used to inspire him. He used to get a high from watching something in nature that was perfect. And because it was perfect and its vibrations were high, his vibrations would be raised within him. And when that happened, he used to have a spiritual experience of superconsciousness, triggered up by this outer experience which raised his inner vibrations. One day he was watching a small bird off the cliffs of Dover, and a high wind, a gale was blowing. And this tiny little bird, the wind of her, tried to beat this high wind that was blowing. And indeed it succeeded. By a flash of its wings, it was able to beat this high wind. And Gerard Manley Hopkins, watching it, had an effusion. Something leapt up from within him. That was perfect, and something that was perfect within him from his own soul leapt up to meet. The two things that were perfect met, as it were. And he had this effusion, this superconscious experience. Let me just read the poem and see how he describes it. "I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dappled, dawn-drawn falcon. In his riding and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off forth on swing as a skate's heel swing smooth on a bow bend. The hurl and gliding of the bird rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for that bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, oh air, pride, plume, here buckle. And the fire that breaks from me then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my Chevalier. He had this experience welling up within him, triggered off by seeing something beautiful, something natural in nature. What an incredible person he was. He found that he could have months and months of complete aridity, like you have, like I have. Periods in which we can do nothing, nothing at all. Life is a drudge. What we're trying to do can't be done. Nothing works. And then there would be suddenly, in the midst of all this extreme tension and this aridity, and then it would all change, and suddenly the creative force would flow through him, and he could write endless poetry hour after hour, day after day. And this is what we mean, harmony through conflict. He describes this in the last lines of this poem, and he depicts, as it were, a grate of coals, a fire settling down in the middle of the night. And here the coals are settled down in dark, just an occasional blue flame licking up. And everything is non-productive, stagnant. No fire, no flames, no heat, nothing. Just like him when he can't produce anything. And then he describes it. And blue, bleak embers, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. Blue, bleak embers fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. Suddenly the coals, the blue, black coals in the grate, fall. And as they fall, they collapse in the grate, the two coals hit each other. And with that tension, that conflict of the two coals hitting each other, there's a shower of sparks, gashing gold vermilion. And this is how his life was. There was this intense conflict, and suddenly a crisis. There, a bird beating the high wind changed it all, and he became creative. Well, perhaps you have this artistic bent within you, the ray of art and harmony through conflict. And perhaps for you, the creation of, or the observation of something in the world of artistic glory will bring a rushing out from you of something which is similar to that glory. Then there is the third ray of active intelligence. And we could really say this is the path of karma yoga. This is the path in which the person has an opportunity to serve mankind. And it is a way of approach, and it's a very, very valid one. Some people can't meditate. They've spent 30 years trying to meditate, and they can't. Other people can't study and focus the mind. There is yet a third way. The third way is to serve mankind. And intense service of mankind can produce results in the way that I'm going to describe. As we often used to say in the early days, they also serve who merely pay their fees. We are serving sometimes in the most unimaginable ways. But this way, the third ray of active intelligence, offers an opportunity for people who can't meditate and can't study. And they are numerous. They are legion. And this is the way. The way is to throw themselves into a group, to make themselves part of a group of others, part of a sentient living being, whatever the group may be. A group, a church, some organization. They make themselves part of the group. And that group will enable them to have an initiation. They can't get it on their own. They aren't able to meditate. They aren't able to study the classics. They have something to give to the group. It may be just activity, service capacity. And if the group is a real group, if it has all the elements of a living thing, and all groups are living things, then it is eligible for initiation itself. And the person in the group receives the initiation that the group gets. Now that's an important consideration. especially for the age of Aquarius, that many people will be able to have initiation, normally not available to them on their own, but by virtue of the fact they are part of a group, and if the group is of a high order and doing wonderful things for mankind, they can be initiated and have superconscious experience because they are members of a group. And that is something of intense importance in these days. Such a group would absorb this person, and if that person gave himself constantly, enduringly, in every way possible in serving his fellow men, then through a group he can have superconscious experience. And then there is the second ray of love wisdom. And more than half of the people in this audience tonight have souls which vibrate to the second ray of love wisdom. This is the ray of quality. This is the ray that teaches meditation as a means for recognizing the quality of an object, the quality of a flower, the quality of a man, the soul nature of a man. This is the ray of quality. And these people, by meditation or by observation in the world, always have to search for quality. Not the form, not the life force, but the effect of the life force in the form, which is quality. Quality of a thing. They're always trying to understand it. For them, they must learn qualities through the opening of the third eye. They must learn, as it were, to visualize something and to focus their mind on what is visualized in order to get the quality from it. And that ability to understand and interpret quality produces the true poet. And more than half the masters have been poets at some time or the other in their lives. And poets are always people who know how to visualize, to create visual images within them. I might be forgiven of quoting Wordsworth again. For oft whilst on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they, the daffodils, flash upon that inward eye which is the bliss of solitude, the ability to visualize inwardly and to focus on what is visualized, to be able to detect the quality of things, to meditate on something and see its quality, not its outer form, which is as nothing compared to its quality. Shakespeare shows this beautifully in The Merchant of Venice when he describes the quality behind mercy. Listen to it. The quality of mercy is not strange. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives it and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptral sway. It is enthroned in the heart of kings. It is a tribute to God himself. An earthly power is closest to God when mercy seasons justice. It's hard to understand Shakespeare, even when it is beautifully recited. But let us just pick out one or two little points here. The quality of mercy. It says that it blesseth him that gives it and him that takes it, which is a wonderful understanding of mercy. It is twice blessed in this way. Then he says, 'tis mightiest in the mightiest. It's no criterion for an insignificant person to give mercy. A humble person frequently gives mercy. But when a mighty person who needn't give it at all, who's powerful and strong and doesn't need the favors of anybody, when he gives mercy, 'tis mightiest in the mightiest. What a wonderful underlying quality that is to mercy, and Shakespeare gives it. And then he says, it becomes the throne of monarch better than his crown. It is becoming to the throne of monarch much better than the crown. The crown is as nothing compared to a monarch who gives mercy. Mercy is far more important and becoming to a monarch than his crown. What a wonderful thing it is to be able to look into the meaning of things, the quality behind things, the quality of mercy. And these who tread this path, those who tread this path, the second race souls, they are the music makers, and they are the dreamers of dreams, wandering by lone sea breakers and sitting by desolate streams. They're world losers and world forsakers on whom the pale moon gleams, but they are the makers and shakers of the world forever, it seems. The great secondary attributes. The people who hide from the world, even if they have to live in the thick of everyday living, they withdraw from the world and become the music makers. They who wander by lone sea breakers, hidden from the world, pondering and brooding the meaning of life, the meaning behind the words of the classics that they are studying. This is the gentle second ray of love wisdom, love wisely applied, wisdom lovingly applied. These are the qualities of love wisdom. I don't know who's doing that, I'm not. And then finally, the first ray of will and power. And the third of the audience has souls on the first ray of will and power. And if they have personalities on the first ray of will and power, then indeed this would be the way for them. The motto is, the kingdom of heaven is taken by storm. The kingdom of heaven is taken by assault or storm. And that is the way of the first ray of will and power. What do they do? Their way is, as it were, to act as a frontiersman. They emphasize all approaches which have so far been mentioned, the seventh ray, the sixth ray of devotion. They will use energy, anything, for these people are not only frontiersmen, they are strategists. They are strategists. And they will constantly survey the situation of their spiritual unfoldment. And they will take any opportunity which presents itself to push through to the fifth kingdom, to take that kingdom by storm. All is sacrificed in these people's lives. They give up their homes, they give up comfort and wealth, they give up everything, position and affluence and reputation. The kingdom of heaven is taken by storm by these people who will give up everything for it. They're like the alchemists of old, and alchemy is ruled by the first ray of will and power. The old alchemists, when they once got their furnace going and the possibility of gold being made there, and some of them did make gold, then everything went into the furnace. They would strip themselves and their families and everything of their wealth in order to keep the furnace going. This is the sort of approach by the first ray. But more than anything, these first ray people learn that God geometrizes. God geometrizes. He not only creates form out of patterns and symbols, like the one that is illustrated at the very end there, a mandala. He not only creates form out of patterns and symbols, but he energizes them accordingly, according to the different energies which are related to these symbols. Last night I pointed out how the triangle and the pyramid is related to the second ray of love wisdom. I pointed out how, for instance, the sphere and the round lens is related to will and power, the first ray. I pointed out how the square and the cube, its projection, are related to the third ray of active intelligence. And the whole world between the fifth kingdom and the fourth kingdom is populated with symbols. We cannot interpret a formless world with words that describe form. Impossible. When we begin to penetrate, especially the first ray, man, the frontiersman, begins to probe this new frontier of the fifth kingdom, he comes up against the symbols of God, the symbols of that next kingdom. God geometrizes in forms of pyramids and spheres and lenses and mandalas especially. That is the no man's land between the fifth and the fourth kingdom. And this individual has to probe and reach through those symbols. Each symbol offers him energy according to the quality of that form. If the symbol is triangular or prismatic or pyramidal, then the energy that would be released from that symbol when he comes into contact, it is love wisdom. And when he comes up against mandalas, similarly, they have certain qualities. And this is the frontiersman using symbols. God geometrizes and taking advantage of those symbols and using them each time more and more effectively. A simple symbol to begin with, like a cube, and then going further inwards and reaching a more complex symbol, and then higher and higher in no man's land until the actual master himself is reached. And they keep on and press forward. And there are many, many examples in the human body of such symbols. The human eye is a perfect sphere. The human eye is a perfect sphere, and it has certain qualities. It contains a lens and so on. Such beings work in the world of symbols, and they fight their way through to the next kingdom. As Robert Browning, my own master, says, in man's self arise august anticipations, symbols, types of a dim splendor, ever on before in that eternal circle of life which it pursues. There's the circle of life, the mandala, full of symbols. For such men begin to pass their nature's bound and find new hopes and cares which fast supplant their proper joys and griefs. They grow too great for narrow creeds of right and wrong which fade before the unmeasured thirst for good, while peace rises within them ever more and more. Such men are even now upon the earth, serene amid the half-formed creatures ranged around. The Master Kutumi, who was once Francis of Assisi and before that Pythagoras, said this of mankind. He said to man, he said, thou shalt be deathless. You will be gods imperishable, no longer mortal. What wonderful words those are, which egg us on, lead us on virtually to a new kingdom, the kingdom of gods. I often sympathize with materialists, with people who think this is a lot of baloney, who think that this so-called mystical path has no such rewards as it describes. May I end by quoting one more poem which so adequately describes these people. It's called A Butterfly. In this poem, there is a comparison of such individuals with people like ourselves. A butterfly rested upon a flower. Gay was he, and light as a flake. And there he met a caterpillar, sobbing as though his heart would break. It hurt the happy butterfly to see a caterpillar cry. Said he, whatever is the matter, and may I help in any way? I've lost my brother, wept the other. He's been unwell for many a day, and now I discover, sad to tell, he's only dead, an empty shell. Unhappy grub, be done with weeping. Your sickly brother is not dead, his body's stronger, and no longer crawls like a worm, but flies instead. He dances through the sunny hours and drinks sweet nectar from the flowers. Away, away, you deceitful villain. Go to the winds where you belong. I won't be grieving at your leaving, so take away your lying tongue. Am I a foolish slug or snail to swallow such a fairy tale? I'll prove my words to you, you unbeliever. Now listen well and look at me. Am I none other than your brother, alive and well and fancy-free? Soon you'll be with me in the skies amongst the flirting butterflies. Oh, cried the mournful caterpillar, 'tis clear I must be seeing things. You're only a spectre, sipping nectar, flicking your ornamental wings and talking nonsense by the yard. I will not hear another word. The butterfly gave up the struggle. I have, he said, no more to say. He spread his splendid wings and ascended into the air and flew away. And while he fluttered far and wide, the caterpillar sat and cried. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.